ಜನವಲ್ಲಭ ಗಿರಿವರಧಾರಿ ಗೋಪೀ ಜನವಲ್ಲಭ ಗಿರಿವರಧಾರಿ ಯಶೋದಾನಂದನ ಬ್ರಜ ಜನರಂಜನ ಯಶೋದಾನಂದನ ಬ್ರಜ ಜನರಂಜನ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರವನ ಚಾರಿ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರವನ ಚಾರಿ ಜಯ ರಾಧಾ ಮಾಧವ ಕುಂಜ ವಿಹಾರಿ ಜಯ ಗೋಪೀ ಜನವಲ್ಲಭ ಗಿರಿವರಧಾರಿ ಯಶೋದಾನಂದನ ಬ್ರಜ ಜನರಂಜನ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರವನ ಚಾರಿ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರವನ ಚಾರಿ ಜಯ ರಾಧಾ ಮಾಧವ ಕುಂಜ ವಿಹಾರಿ ಜಯ ರಾಧಾ ಮಾಧವ ಕುಂಜ ವಿಹಾರಿ
ವಿಷ್ಣುಪಾದ ಪರಮಹಂಸ ಪರಿವ್ರಾಜಕಾಚಾರ್ಯ ಅಷ್ಟೋತ್ತರ ಶತಶ್ರೀ ಶ್ರೀಮದ್ ಹಿಸ್ ಡಿವೈನ್ ಗ್ರೇಸ್ ಎಸಿ ಭಕ್ತಿ ವೇದಾಂತ ಸ್ವಾಮಿ ಶ್ರೀಲ ಪ್ರಭುಪಾದ ಕೀ ಜಯ ಅನಂತ ಕೋಟಿ ವೈಷ್ಣವ ವೃಂದ ಕೀ ಜಯ ಗ್ರಂಥರಾಜ್ ಶ್ರೀಮದ್ ಭಾಗವತಂ ಕೀ ಜಯ ಆಲ್ ಗ್ಲೋರೀಸ್ ಟು ದಿ ಅಸೆಂಬಲ್ ಡಿವೋಟೀಸ್ ಆಲ್ ಗ್ಲೋರೀಸ್ ಟು ದಿ ಅಸೆಂಬಲ್ ಡಿವೋಟೀಸ್ ಆಲ್ ಗ್ಲೋರೀಸ್ ಟು ಶ್ರೀ ಶ್ರೀ ಗುರು ಅಂಡ್ ಗೌರಂಗ ನಾರಾಯಣಂ ನಮಸ್ಕೃತ್ಯ ನರಂ ಚೈವ ನರೋತ್ತಮಂ ದೇವೀಂ ಸರಸ್ವತಿಂ ವ್ಯಾಸಂ ತತೋ ಜಯಮುದೀರಯೇತ್ ನಷ್ಟಪ್ರಾಯೇಷು ಅಭದ್ರೇಷು ನಿತ್ಯಂ ಭಾಗವತ ಸೇವಯ ಭಗವತಿ ಉತ್ತಮ ಶ್ಲೋಕೇ ಭಕ್ತಿರ್ಭವತಿ ನೈಷ್ಠಿಕಿ ಓಂ ನಮೋ ಭಗವತೆ ವಾಸುದೇವಾಯ ಓಂ ನಮೋ ಭಗವತೆ ವಾಸುದೇವಾಯ ಓಂ ನಮೋ ಭಗವತೆ ವಾಸುದೇವಾಯ ಕ್ಯಾಂಟೋ 9 ಚಾಪ್ಟರ್ 9 ದಿ ಡೈನಸ್ಟಿ ಆಫ್ ಅಂಶುಮನ್ ಟೆಕ್ಸ್ಟ್ ಜಲಸ್ಪರ್ಶ ಟೆಕ್ಸ್ಟ್ 12 ಯಜ್ಜಲಸ್ಪರ್ಶ ಮಾತ್ರೇಣ ब्रह्मदण्डहतापि सगरात्मजाद् दिवं जग्मो केवलं देहमस् केवलं देहभस्मभि यज्जलस्पर्शमात्रेण ब्रह्मदण्डहतापि सगरात्मजादिवं जग्मो केवलं देहभस्मभिः यज्जलस्पर्शमात्रेण ब्रह्मदण्डहतापि सगरात्मजादिवं जग्मो केवलं देहभस्मभिः यज्जलस्पर्शमात्रेण ब्रह्मदण्डाहतापि सगरात्मजादिवं जग्मो यज्जलस्पर्शमात्रेण ब्रह्मदण्डाहतापि यज्जलस्पर्शमात्रेण ब्रह्मदण्डाहतापि सगरात्मजादिवं जग्मो केवलं देहभस्मभिः यज्जलस्पर्शमात्रेण ब्रह्मदण्डाहतापि सगरात्मजादिवं जग्मो केवलं देहभस्मभिः यज्जल हूज़ वाटर स्पर्शमात्रेण सिंपली बाय टचिंग Brahmadandahataha, those who were condemned for offending Brahma, the Self, Api, although Sagara Atmajaha, the sons of Sagara, Divam, to the heavenly planets, Jagmuhu, went, Kevalam, only. Dehabhasmabhihi, by the remaining ashes of their burnt bodies. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So I'm going to read a few of the previous translations where there are no purports, so there's a sense of continuity. Text 9. When King Bhagiratha approached Lord Shiva, and requested him to sustain the forceful waves of the Ganges, Lord Shiva accepted the proposal by saying, "Let it be so." Then with great attention, he sustained the Ganges on his head, for the water of the Ganges is purifying, having emanated from the toes of Lord Vishnu. The great and saintly King Bhagiratha brought the Ganges, which can deliver all the fallen souls, to that place on earth where the bodies of his forefathers lay burnt to ashes. Bhagiratha mounted a swift chariot and drove before Mother Ganges, who followed him, purifying many countries until they reached the ashes of Bhagiratha's forefathers, the sons of Sagara, who were thus sprinkled with water from the Ganges. Then today's verse. Because the sons of Sagar Maharaj had offended a great personality, the heat of their bodies had increased and they were burnt to ashes. But simply by being sprinkled with water from the Ganges, all of them became eligible to go to the heavenly planets. What then is to be said of those who use the water of Mother Ganges to worship her? Purport. Mother Ganges is worshipped by the water of the Ganges. A devotee takes a little water from the Ganges and offers it back to the Ganges. When the devotee takes the water, Mother Ganges does not lose anything. And when the water is offered back, Mother Ganges does not increase. But in this way, the worshipper of the Ganges is benefited. Similarly, a devotee of the Lord offers the Lord patram pushpam phalam toyam, a leaf, flower, fruit or water, in great devotion. But everything including the leaf, flower, fruit and water belongs to the Lord, and therefore there is nothing to renounce or accept. One must simply take advantage of the bhakti process, because by following this process one does not lose anything, but one gains the favor of the Supreme Person. Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamahyam Dadati Sva Padantikam Vancha Kalpaturubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shrivas Adi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So there are some new faces in the audience. We'd like to welcome you. Thank you for coming. Some new faces. Thank you for coming. And as well for everyone else. Some of us are here not so often, so for sake of continuity of the pastime, this is the ninth canto where the pastimes of Lord Ramachandra are being discussed. And Shukadeva Goswami tells Parikshit Maharaj, you've heard about Lord Ram in detail many times, so I'm just going to give a summary. So he's speeding through the pastimes, if you will. So this year we're going to, our spiritual master is taking us to Ayodhya for Yatra. So I've been trying to, on the side, study Srimad Ramayana. So to just get an appreciation for the pastimes of Lord Ram. So I will tell you a little bit more detail of the story of Mother Ganges. So the situation is here, King Sagara's 60,000 sons. I'm going to go back a little bit if you don't mind. King Sagara had two wives, Keshini and Sumati. And they had served a particular sage very nicely. So sages, they like to give blessings. So he said to King Sagara Maharaj, I give you the blessing that through one wife, you can get 60,000 powerful sons. So powerful that their strength cannot be compared anywhere in the universe. And through another wife, you'll get one son who'll make the whole dynasty glorious. So you two ladies, you tell me which one you want. So Sumati said, I'll take the 60,000, please. And Keshini said, I'll take the one son. So through Sumati, 60,000 sons were born. Through Keshini, one son by the name Asamanjasa was born. And Asamanjasa is referred to here, previous verses. He was a little weird, if you will. He was weird in this way. He would take children and throw them into the river and sort of kill them, if you will. So the parents were a little worried, you know, this boy, he doesn't know how to handle other children. It's a little scary. So there is a little pastime in the Ramayana that describes Asamanjasas, and Prabhupada refers to it here, past. In his previous life, Asamanjasa was a very accomplished yogi. So one of the things about yoga, that when one gets these yogic powers, along with those powers comes pride. So he was proud. But he was a very accomplished yogi. And in his next birth, those yogic powers continued, but no one knew about it. So when he was told, Asamanjasa, what's going on? Why are you... With his yogic potency, he brought all those children back from the dead. Then they realized he's not an ordinary person. But because of his pride, he had to take another birth. This is a consequence of pride. So these 60,000 sons, they were very strong, very able. And Sagar Maharaj was performing a Ashwamedha Yajna. So we know the story. King Indra stole the horse. And so, like in the fire sacrifice, we were discussing it on Wednesday night, that if you're doing a fire yajna, and at the right moment, you suddenly realize there's no ghee, where are the grains? You're in anxiety. So King Sagara was in anxiety. Where's the horse? Where's the horse? Where's the horse? No one knew. They started searching round about. They couldn't find the horse. So he told his 60,000 sons, go find the horse. So they designed a system by which they would cover every inch of the earth planet. They searched it like anything and they couldn't find the horse. So they came back and said, I'm sorry, we couldn't find it. King Sagara said, oh, I cannot continue the yajna without the horse. So wherever the horse is, find it. So they started digging, they started searching this place, that place, and they went down the universe one level after the other. So we know there are seven layers below the earthly realm. Atala, Vitala, Sutala, Talatala, Rasatala and Patala. So they started digging and searching all through the subterranean regions. They came to Patala. And in the ashram of Kapila Muni, he was meditating there, and he was sitting and meditating, and the horse was grazing around him. So they said, ah, this is the person. Now he's sitting in meditation, acting as if he's some great soul, but he's a thief. And they all ran to hurt Kapila Muni. So Lord Kapila opened his eyes and looked at him. And here it says, Brahma Danda Hata. They had performed the offense. They committed an offense of offending the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Kapila Muni. And because of that offense, the heat in their body increased very quickly. Like we all have heat in our body. 98.6, we're happy it is that way, because if it becomes less than that, we're gone. If it goes more than that, then it's danger. We call it fever, 104. But if it hits the magic number 108, so we are asked now why there are 108 beads on the Japamala. It is to make sure that our temperature doesn't go to that level, because after that we're done. The body heat. But it takes time for heat to grow. In this case, the heat became so strong, so quickly, that at a moment, they became 60,000 lumps of ashes. And just plopped there. So Sagar Maharaj is now in deep distress. Not only has he lost the horse, he lost his 60,000 sons. So then Asamanjasa's son, Anshuman, after many hundreds of years, because they all used to live very long, had this thing in his heart that my grandfather's wish that those uncles be delivered has not been fulfilled. So I will take it on, because it's the duty within the family to relieve one's ancestors from hellish condition. That's the meaning of the word putra. Putra in Sanskrit means son. And like we say mantra, and we explain everyone, mantra means that which releases the mind. Putra means one who releases the ancestors from the hellish condition called put. P-U-T. Putra. So that's why they're supposed to, every son is supposed to perform certain rites to release the previous three generations from hellish condition. So Anshuman thought, what's the best way? And he was told that the best way is when the water of the Ganges will touch these ashes. If any one of us was told water of the Ganges, we would walk to Goloka Prabhu or Radharaman Prabhu and say, can I get some Ganges water from the cabinet, please? Or we may take the ashes to Ganges, which many people do. I took my father's ashes as well and mix in the Ganges. But there's only one problem for Anshuman. What was the problem? There was no Ganges on the earthly realm at that time. So it's like, how do I mix the ashes in a river that doesn't exist? So he said, boy, what to do? He tried in meditation, trying to see if Ganges will become pleased and descend to the earthly realm. He spent his whole life performing austerities. She didn't come. So next, his son, Dilipa, after many thousands of years, because they live long, right? Many thousands of years, he grew up, he became the king, and he performed many, many austerities. And the Ramayana says, his mind was disturbed because he didn't know, will she ever show up or not? So many thousands of years have passed. Is this going to work or not? His mind was mixed with some sorrow. But he meditated for thousands of years. Ganga Devi did not appear. Meanwhile, those 60,000 lumps of ash are still waiting. So many thousands of years pass, and Dilipa has a son by the name Bhagiratha, which is being spoken here of. So Bhagiratha, he takes up this challenge, not in a proud way, but you know, in a very dutiful way. So he goes up to the Himalayas and stands on his toes, lights five fires around him to make it even more difficult, and then performs austerity, praying to Lord Brahma. So it is said that after 32,000 years, Lord Brahma appeared and said, okay, the Ganges will descend. Even Ganga Devi said she will come, but there is a problem. The Ganges, when she appeared to him and she said, I'll agree to come, she said, my waters are very forceful. I don't come as a drop or something. I come as a massive hydro force. And if I come with that force, the entire earthly realm will become shattered. So you need to make some arrangement to break that force. Otherwise, you know, your austerity is such that it causes damage a lot more than benefit. So he said, what to do? Oh, and in his long austerity, he would stand on his toes and once in a year would drink a little water. That was all his austerity was. So severe. So now he has to make arrangement not only for the Ganges to come, but also for the waters to be speed to be, the force to be broken, or some resistance needs to be there. We call it dampers. You need to dampen. So he went back on his toes, back into austerity. And Lord Brahma appeared and said, pray to Lord Shiva and ask him to accept the service of breaking the force of the Ganges water. Yes, thank you. Went back on his toes again. Because every time he needs something, he has to appease the higher authorities. So he went back. And Lord Shiva said, no problem. She can descend on my head. And my hair, I will put it up in locks. So he's the original one with the dreadlocks. And he said, let her come. I will capture her in my dreadlocks. So the point here is something of value or benefit unto others, if we want to do, doesn't come easy. It comes at the cost of great austerity. And without austerity, nothing comes. Nothing comes easy. And he wants to benefit. He wants to benefit not just his 60,000 great grand uncles, but also all humanity for the rest of time. So Ganga Devi, because she is young and bubbly and very energetic, she has a little arrogance in her heart. This is from Ramayana. And her arrogance is, haha, I'll fall on Lord Shiva's head, but I will go with even more force and enter the lower planetary systems on my own. So Lord Shiva detects that little arrogance and pride, because anytime anyone has any gift or ability, in general in this world, that gift or ability comes with some pride. Because if someone can sing well, speak well, cook well, manage well, whatever, worship well, you know, they're artists, they're very good at this, they're good at that, whatever it is, it always, in the material world, that skill, that gift comes with pride. So Ganga Devi also had a little pride in her heart. Lord Shiva knew. He said, Missy, I will teach you a lesson. When you descend, I will capture you in my dreadlocks, that not a drop of you will pass on. So she came, and he captured in his dreadlocks. She was swirling inside those dreadlocks, they were full of caves and big crevices and places that she filled everything up, but she couldn't come out. You know, you see in some movies there's a big force of water and that breaks everything. So she came with a greater force, but Lord Shiva's jata did not allow her to escape because of the pride. So we observe in our life that sometimes we have a great ability and we think we have that skill, we're arrogant or some pride is there, and we try to do and it doesn't work. Anyone had that experience? It doesn't work and you try again and try again, and others are waiting for you to, sometimes even open a lid or can and you're like, I've done this. I know I've done this in the past, but somehow it doesn't come and it's a little embarrassing. It's like, man. So it's like that. So Bhagiratha, he imagined him, he's been meditating, performing austerities, she's almost there, he's seeing that she's in Lord Shiva's dreadlocks, but she's not coming out. So then for another long period of time, Bhagiratha performed austerity. My dear Lord Shiva, please let her go. Please let her go. So Lord Shiva allowed a few drops to come out. And those few drops become the Ganges. So if you ever go to Gaumukh, you went to Gaumukh? You went to Gangotri. Gaumukh is further east, northeast of Gangotri. Gangotri is officially the place where you see the Ganges flowing. It's almost like a stream. If you go to Gaumukh, all you see is a massive glacier and just drops of water. That is the origin of Ganga. That's it, just a few drops trickling down. Anyway, Lord Shiva allowed only a few drops, a very slight stream, very little, to come up. And one of the names of Ganges is Tripathaga. Tripathaga means one who flows in three directions. Or it also means that there are three sources of origin. It also means that she prevails in three different areas. So all three meanings will give. So the first meaning of Tripathaga is from this stream that came out from Lord Shiva's head. Seven streams came out. That's from that seven, three go east, three go west, and one went behind King Bhagirath. The three that going east have different names. Pavani, Khaladini, etc. The three that go west have three other names. They're all tributaries. And the one that went behind Bhagiratha became officially known as the Ganges. So that's one meaning of the word Tripathaga. Another meaning is that she dwells in the three realms. The heavenly realms, the earthly realm, and the, we call it hellish realm or the subterranean realm. In the heavenly realm, she is called Mandakini. In the earthly realm, she is called Bhagirathi, because she is following Bhagiratha. And in the lower realm, she is called by the name Bhogavati. That's the second meaning of the word Tripathaga. And in the previous 8th canto, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives another meaning of the word Tripathaga. This has three sources. One source is that when Vamana Dev put his foot up to cover the entire higher planetary regions, his toe pierced through the coverings of the universe. It must be a big toe. And through the piercing, the causal waters leaked into the universe. That's called the Ganges. Another time, in the first and second canto, when the creation is being talked about, it is described that Lord Narayana expanded himself into the Ganges water. She's an expansion of his energy. That's the second source. And in the same 8th canto, when Bali Maharaj one is in that condition, is described that Lord Brahma sprinkled water from his kamandalu, his transcendental pot. And that is called the Ganges. So Tripathaga, three different sources. So now, if you see in these translations, because it is summary, he's fast-forwarding the story. So we've come up to how she comes out of Lord Shiva's jata. He says Lord Shiva bore her with great attention, having emanated from the toes of Lord Vishnu. Then the verse says, the great and saintly King Bhagiratha brought the Ganges, which can deliver all the fallen souls, to that place on earth where the bodies of his forefathers. So between Gomukh and where Kapila's ashram is, it's a long path. If you know the trajectory or path of the Ganges, so there are some stories in between. Because that Ganges is coming with, although it's a trickle that fell from Lord Shiva's hair, that trickle itself is a massive, forceful river. So as King Bhagiratha sat rode on his chariot and started directing her, she was following him. So in the Himalayas, there is a place called Janu Ashram. Did you go there? Okay. So there is Badrinath, Kedarnath, Gangotri. If you look at the map of the Himalayas from here, it's this way. For you, Badrinath, Kedarnath, Gangotri, and Kapila's ashram is where the Ganges meets the ocean near Mayapur. So you have to come from the Himalayas all that way. So as you come down in the Himalayas, there is an ashram of a sage called Janu Rishi. Now, Janu Rishi was performing some fire yagya. Now Ganga Devi, she had a little, you know, little childish exuberance in her. So she inundated his entire ashram and fire yagya and interrupted and disturbed his fire yagya. So he became upset. And by his yogic potency, he swallowed the entire river. And Bhagirath is like, please let it go. The reason I'm narrating is this, I want all of us to enter into the step into the shoes of Maharaj Bhagirath, that we want to accomplish something and there are so many obstacles in what we want to accomplish, and many people lose heart, they lose determination, they say what's the point. And here is King Bhagiratha, who doesn't lose his determination. He's despite so many obstacles on his path. This is one of the quintessential teachings of the Ramayana, that in one's meeting one's objective, there are many, many obstacles. And one whose sight, a vision is fixed on the ultimate goal, regardless of how many obstacles and interruptions and disappointments there are, somehow they're determined to continue. Okay. As we think of King Bhagirath, we can think of Srila Prabhupada. He has a goal and so many obstacles, interruptions, disappointments, this thing, failures, this, that, everything. Sometimes environmental factors that you have no control over, yet his determination was strong. Dridhavrata. So Bhagirath was Dridhavrata. Now Janu Rishi swallowed Ganges and said, forget it, you cannot go anywhere. So he went back to his knees and said, please let her go. I have been meditating, praying, performing austerities to let her come. Please don't stop her. So he was pleased and satisfied. And to break the pride in Ganges, he made her his daughter, because daughter means she's in a subordinate position. And he let her out through his ear. What great sages. They all these. Don't ask me how to perform that. Most of us have difficulty letting water out, just its normal course with, you know, kidneys failing, this and that. So what to speak of from the ear and all that. So because she became his daughter, she got the name Jahnavi. It's a beautiful name of a Ganges, Jahnavi, because she is the daughter of Janu Rishi. So anyway, finally, through all these different places, it's described in the Ramayana how she started, wherever she touched the ground, things became opulent, verdant, rich with minerals, fruits, flower, trees. She was just lighting up the whole place as she was going, lighting it up green, and finally reached Kapila Muni's ashram. That's this verse. Yad jalasparshamatrena. As soon as the waters touched those lumps of ashes, sagaratmaja. Sagara atmaja means the one who's born from sagara, and it's plural, atmajaha. So all the 60,000 sons who were sitting there, kevalam deha bhasmi bi, they were sitting there simply as piles of ash. Bhasma means ash. He says, Divam Jagmo. They went to the heavenly realm. Even though they were very sinful. What was the sinful? Brahma Danda Hata Api. Even though they were very, very sinful, they had committed a very grievous or heinous crime or offense, just by the touch of the Ganges water, they immediately went to the heavenly realm. That's the power of the Ganges. That is why tradition goes, from then on, everyone who's departed from this world, regardless of who they are, their ashes somehow are taken to the Ganges or the Yamuna. Because as soon as those ashes touch, then although they were destined to go to hellish conditions, they go to heavenly realms. It's a concession ticket. Otherwise, not qualified. It's a very, very special stroke of mercy. So that's the potency of the Ganges River. The potency she has is because those waters have touched the lotus feet of Lord Vishnu. That's the power. And that power is recognized by Lord Shiva, and so he accepts that water on his head. Otherwise, Lord Shiva has no need to oblige anyone. But he does, because he said, hey, it's a great opportunity to get some Charanamrit. Sure, no problem. And Prabhupada says that the best way to worship Ganges is to take some water from the Ganges and offer it back. Because we can't get Ganges water from anywhere else but the Ganges. But when we take some Ganges water, it doesn't make any difference to the Ganges. And when you give it back, it doesn't make a difference to her anyway. But just by the act of taking Ganges water and offering it back to her, we, the performer of such an activity, become very blessed and benefited. Similarly, everything around us is given by Krishna and belongs to Krishna. Ishavasyam idam sarvam. We are meant to take things, yat kinchit jagatyam jagat, and offer it back in service to Krishna. Because we cannot create anything. We do create something. What do we create? No. Mobile phone also, we need the elements. But we create something. What do we create? We create nuisance. That we're good at. We can create nuisance. Everything else we cannot create. So we take from what is available as raw materials given by Krishna, and we offer it back in service. Then we are benefited. Prabhupada says, by following this process, one does not lose anything, but one gains the favor of the Supreme Person. So that's the objective of life. How do we gain the favor of the Supreme Person? That's the question to answer. In any situation, that's the million-dollar question to answer. How do I gain the favor of the Supreme Person? Whether the problem that we are solving is small, the situation we are in is small, medium, large, extra large, double XL, whatever is the size of the problem or the situation we are in, our main question is, how do I gain the favor of the Supreme Person? Just that question orients us in the direction of the bhakti process. And if you don't know about the bhakti process, then it orients us in the direction of the devotees who will tell us about the bhakti process. That's, you see, our thoughts orient our mind and body into our actions. Correct? I'm thirsty, let's say. I feel, I'm thirsty. I want to drink some water. So my mind will scan as to where there is water. There is water here. Then my body orients towards that. It's not like I can walk there to get water there. I have to orient my body towards where water will be available. So our thoughts orient our body. It's just how it is. So if I don't want to get up, my thought is just sleep in a little bit more. It orients my body to remain in the horizontal plane a little longer than in the vertical plane. Our thoughts orient our bodies, just how it is. So just the very thought, how can I gain the favor of the Supreme, will orient us internally and externally towards finding an answer for that question. It will orient us to go to the Bhagavatam, the Ramayana, books of Srila Prabhupada. It will orient us to go ask a devotee. It will orient us to perform some service to gain the favor of a devotee behind whom follows the favor of the Supreme Person. We cannot get Krishna's mercy without a devotee's mercy. Impossible. It is just not possible that Krishna's mercy comes without the mercy of a devotee. There has never been in history any situation like that. That's why when people say, I was just sitting somewhere and I became enlightened. It's just not the process. Nobody becomes enlightened like that. Then we have to tell that person, oh, I don't need you. I can also sit somewhere and become enlightened. But the idea is without Guru, Guru is the medium. And Guru definition is not a very narrow definition, not one person per se. But the medium is called Guru. Guru because it's a very heavy medium through which Krishna's mercy is very heavy. It's not something to be taken lightly. But that comes through medium or different media. And the persons are the carriers of that mercy. And those persons perform certain function, different to different degrees, to different intensities. But they are the ones who carry Krishna's mercy. So Krishna's mercy doesn't come without the mercy of a devotee. So as soon as we ask, how do I gain the favor of the Supreme Person? Our internal and external orientation towards the bhakti process begins. And as we keep asking that question in every situation, not only does the orientation grow, but the intensity, the being in that direction continues. And the process is very simple. Take what you find in the world and use it in Krishna's service. The statement is simple. The application is always not easy. And to decode that simple statement, it requires some austerity. Spiritual austerity. And the spiritual austerity is called Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, given by Rupa Goswami. Certain things we need to do, certain things we should not do, certain practices to take up, certain practices to give up. And all of this, there are two things that we should always do. Always remember Krishna and never forget Him. All of the rules and regulations are merely but subordinate principles. Satatam smartavyo Vishnu vismartavyo na jatu chit sarve vidhi nishedasyor evayoreta kinkaraha. All other rules and regulations are simply subordinate to the prime rules and regulations. The prime two rules are always remember Krishna, never forget Him. That's the practice. And that practice is our austerity to decode the secret of how to take everything and use in Krishna's service to gain His favor. Any questions, comments, thoughts, objections?
Question on what happens when the ashes are there. So just the fact that after many, many, many thousands of years, they still will be able to be delivered from whatever activity they committed in that those bodies that are gone.
Yeah.
The body of the 16,000 are gone. And now they're supposed to be in some other place.
Right.
I'm assuming they'll be in some hellish situation. And nevertheless, the ashes, just by the touch of the Ganges, is that even something that happens thousands of years ago, it becomes cleansed.
Yeah.
So the question is, so then, even though the body is gone, even though you may be in some other situation,
yeah,
if somehow or other those ashes get touched by the water of the Ganges, then even you may be in some other body, who knows, body of an animal,
yeah,
and then everything gets cleansed. So then what happens, supposing you are in some other body, then you die and then you go to the heavenly region? Is that the case? Is that a general thing, or is something that is specific to you know, to individuals like that?
At least from the description it is given in the Shastras. let's step back and look at the mechanics of karma. Usually if I had a board at IIT, we would draw it out, but you have to go along with my hand gestures. This is the human level on earth. And we perform activities to accrue karma. So obviously universities and all that, this is usually useful. Human form is the only form where we are generating new karma. And depending upon our activities, we can take birth in higher realms or in lower forms. And wherever lower form we go, or higher form we go, from the human form, there's only one thing we do. We burn, or we exhaust whatever karma is there, to come back to the human form. That's just the mechanics of karma. So let's take an example. From the human form, I went to the tree form, because that's the heaviest karma, where the freedom of movement and expression of free will is curbed to the severest situation. Right? Trees cannot move. So as I exhaust that karma, then I, as the soul, now enter into another form, an aquatic, then to some reptile, then to some bird or animal or insect or animal, back to human life. And if I go up the realm, I did some great activities, I go up to the heavenly realm, and I exhaust and I come back. Now, karma is not always bad or negative, and always not this. It's always a mixture. So depending upon my karmic, so you can't exactly map it out, but it is something like, from human form, I go here, I exhaust that karma, I may be in the heavenly realm, I exhaust that karma, I'll have to come back to the human form, something, I just, till that karma is exhausted, such that there is enough good karma in me to come back to the human form of life. The default condition is back to human life. This is why the Vedic system has more meaning than, let's say, another religion that says you're eternally damned to hell. Then what's the mercy that brings you back for another chance? It's not like you made a mistake and you never get a chance. We always get another chance, always another chance, another chance. It's as eternal as is hell, another chance. So we go up and down depending on that karmic situation. Now, when these ashes touch the Ganges, regardless of what situation one is in, at that life, when that ends, they're elevated here, even if they're not otherwise qualified. They enter here because someone else on their behalf has done a very great act for their benefit. This is like in Nectar of Devotion, we hear Kripa Siddhi. Someone else gives their benefit. And so it goes way up like that. Regardless of what condition they otherwise, of their own karma, were in, they will come to the heavenly realm. That's how it works. Of course, then they come back to human form and they commit foolish things again and go back. That's just how it is. But they are elevated to the heavenly realm immediately as that life is over. All other karmic sinful situations burnt up.
I have another question.
Yeah.
Similar on the same, thank you, that was a very nice answer. Sometimes we get the sense in the narrations of the Mahabharata and the Ramayana that the expectation is for the forefathers to ascend and to be there in a heavenly region.
Right.
So you're almost expected to meet them there. Or to have them there, you know. Sometimes we see the situations in which from the heavenly realm they manifest themselves in the earthly, you know, to communicate with their, you know, descendants. So is that the case that they're still, or is it that they have, it's almost like this, you know, like the Christian believe that
same body,
the same, but you know, it's obviously not the same material body, is made of other elements, but nevertheless it's the same features, or is they can manifest that feature if they need, or how does it work?
I am thinking where in the Ramayana or Mahabharata their ancestors come back to speak to them.
I thought Dasarath Maharaj, when he came to give the blessings to of course Dasarath Maharaj was, you know, back home, back to Godhead, right? But he speaks to Lord Ram and Sita, Mother Sita, after the fire.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, of course, that's,
I haven't gotten that far in the Valmiki, so I don't know for sure. Yeah. And
maybe
I haven't heard.
I'm also mixed with the, you know, folk.
The only reference given in Mahabharata, a reference, not that it doesn't exist, I can't remember right now. The reference given is, it's there in the Bhagavatam, but the detail is in the Mahabharata. In the first canto, it's described that the war is over and the Pandavas, along with all the ladies ahead of them, they walk to the Ganges to offer pinda to the ancestors or the uncles and fathers and whoever died in the war. And the Mahabharata state that the hand of that person who they are offering to comes out of the river to take their offering, and Karna's hand also comes out. That's when Yudhishthira Maharaj says, why is Karna's hand here? Until then, he didn't know that Karna is his older brother. That's the only time there's one reference. I can't remember whether other times when the ancestors descend in that same form. I can't remember. I have to do some research for it. Yeah, Mataji.
So, general question. So, in the bhakti process, you know, especially in the beginning stage, like myself, you know, I have no problem accepting all the main principles, and you know, I tend to get a little confused in the details. When these stories come up, or you know, I just liken it to, you know, like you're saying, doing a yatra and going to places of pilgrimage and hearing all these fantastic stories, And, you know, that's where I feel like my faith kind of gets tested at times, where it's, how much of this am I supposed to accept? It's way too far out for me. Or it's, you know, kind of like, how much of this is legend or not? And then the idea of that, you know, what lessons am I supposed to learn from it? But it doesn't mean that I accept this to be factual right off the bat. I'm learning from it. I accept everything in principle versus the details of it. How do I reconcile that, or how do I move beyond that so that it doesn't deter me from, you know, I think that I get the most, let's just say, uncomfortable about some of the details when I have to explain it to somebody else, or when somebody else expresses doubt and I don't know how to reconcile that.
Mm. So let's take a step back and say that there are stories and there are stories. And let's say there are two categories of storytellers. One category of storytellers is they just like to convey something through symbolism. We call it fable. They have some objective of conveying something, but they do it through certain characters, like in a drama or a movie or some storytelling book, fictitious characters. And the outcome of that is some lesson learned, some entertainment, something to convey to others, you know, whatever. I'm sure there are other benefits. Then there is a second category of storytellers who who is interested in not just conveying some symbolism, but they're conveying they're conveying history, and they're conveying facts in a particular way. Okay? Now the recipient down the stream, down the line, cannot necessarily distinguish one from the other. Well, because just for whatever reason, it looks really nice, you know, and here it looks very nice. For example, Harry Potter and wizardry and magic and that's this, and here there is Janu Rishi swallowing the river and not letting her go. From a recipient's perspective, way down the line, can't tell the difference between one and the other. It's like, wow, nice, whatever, right? So now then, what's important is to go back to the storyteller and look at the life of the storyteller and the purpose behind their storytelling. One purpose is profit, adoration, fame, creativity. It's the urge to tell a story, whatever. And whatever that list is, remains in one sense worldly. Okay? And the other storyteller is not interested in those things, fame, money, profit, but there is something core from their character that's coming. And how do you know is when you read their lifestyle? What do they do when they're not telling the story? So in this case, it's Vyasadev. In that case, it is T.J. Rowling. Okay, I mean, I have nothing against her. I'm just picking on her for no reason. Whoever is a storyteller, right? So what is Vyasadeva's purpose? Is a sage who sat there thinking, I'd like to tell some stories. Is that his purpose? No, there must be something bigger, grander, and perhaps more divine behind it. So the Bhagavatam says what he did, he sat there thinking, how do I benefit these people coming down Kali Yuga? So then when we look at Vyasadeva's character, or for that matter, any of the sage's character, then we wonder, is there purpose there saying, let me play with the minds of the people, you know, just create some fictitious characters. What's more important is the lesson, not so much the character. It's not like that. As important as the lesson is the characters of the persons. So that's one. So to be able to distinguish between this storyteller and that storyteller is very important. That's one. And the second is, we have some inkling of our previous times, but we don't have the insight into time way back then. So our insight into some previous times is, let's say 50 years ago, 100 years ago, before modern warfare, there were soldiers who rode horses and elephants and all of that, right? And fighting with heavy armors, riding a horse, holding a sword, these are not easy. So they must have some exceptional strength and vitality by which they could do that. Okay? And the modern warfare gear is, the lighter you make it, the more, but you know, their ability is lessening. So that gives a little hint as to, in what we call periods beyond what we perhaps know, that there is some gift, some ability. And once in a while, in our modern context, we find people having that gift. Okay, you know, someone can kick a ball and about 500 feet away put it into the hoop, or someone can shoot in this way. The snipers, 2 miles away, they can shoot somebody. Recently, a Canadian sniper apparently shot some guy 2 miles away. It is considered like almost, according to physics, really impossible to calculate, you know, the air, the movement, this, that. But they did it. Some skill. So these give some hint at some exceptional skill level that it exists. Just not common. So when we hear our Vedic history, there are these exceptional persons. We hear about the exceptional person. There are also ordinary people during that time. So these exceptional persons have these exceptional qualities. And we just hear about them. Like we see now, some hints of it. There are some magicians and some yogic people who have yogic power. But we are also in Kali Yuga. That's the third thing. That in Kali Yuga, we see a distorted version of everything. The skill gets distorted, the mentality gets distorted, our ability to perceive things gets distorted, etc., etc. So we have to rely on something outside of our own rational mind. I use the word, my faith gets tested. So then the answer would be, with these three dimensions, hold on to whatever degree you can that your faith allows you to. And everything else you can put in the parking lot. You can put in a bucket that says, I will review them when my faith allows me to review them. Because my rejecting it actually is an act where I'm driven by immature faith. I don't reject it. I put it in a parking lot. And let time between now and then allow me to develop that faith. Whatever it takes for you. For each one of us, it's a different thing. There is some faith in something. So for perhaps the immediate faith is, you know, Prabhupada. What he did is, although we may not have seen it, at least there is enough evidence for it. So there is something in Srila Prabhupada's character and ability. Let me start there. And let me start taking steps from there on. But faith building, faith is not built by time and activity. Faith is also built by mercy. That's just how it is. That's the bhakti process. Otherwise, it would be some other process. In this process, faith is built by mercy and application, these two things. So when we say mercy, we mean association and application. Whatever we hear or read, we try to apply. That's where we go. So yeah, there are many things that are... How does one swallow a whole river and let it out through the ears? I mean, that's just one thing. There's so many other things. So we only bite, or we only chew what we can... Oh yeah, we only bite what we can chew. We start there. Am I anywhere in the neighborhood of answering your question? Okay.
Putting in a parking lot?
Important.
What I'm not ready for, I think I've been doing that. So, you know, thank you for that confirmation. And I have been focusing on really, I guess, emphasizing and understanding and relating to Srila Prabhupada and all of the miracles that he's created in terms of understanding how limited, you know, I am and we are in our own, you know, bodies, of understanding of what, you know, Krishna's energy is and what potencies exist beyond our conception. So I mean, I understand that. It's just sometimes, you know, to your point, sometimes it's easy to disconnect if we're in a position where we're not, you know, fixed enough. So
the convergence of faith and reason, okay, when it comes to meta topics like spirituality, the convergence is only for some time, beyond which reason or rationality doesn't help. If you look at Krishna's pastimes, the reason it comes in the 10th canto and the reason Krishna's pastimes are considered wow is because Krishna systematically breaks every feature of rationality one after the other. It is to free us from that reliance on rationality. That's Lord Ramachandra stays quite a bit within rational things, you know, one wife, difficulty, this, that. And then as the pastimes proceed, he starts breaking it, building a bridge that floats, taking monkeys across. All that is, that's when he starts beginning to break that whole sense of rationality. By the time Krishna's pastime comes, right from the beginning, he just doesn't care for rationality. And that's why it's the most difficult to grasp. So what does Vyasadeva do is, in the Bhagavatam, takes us from the first canto, where rationality and faith go quite together. There's a scientific explanation in the third canto of the creation process. Everything is very, quite a bit rational. And slowly we'll start diverging from there. That's just how it is. Okay. Uh-oh. What have I said? Whatever. Yeah, I'm sure. 9 o'clock is when we do.
The question is, say Bhagirath, by his austerity, brought Mother Ganges because she was able to recognize, I guess, the purity of his austerities, and so she responded to his desire that she come so that he could deliver his forefathers. So in the case of King Dilipa, you were describing from the Ramayana that in the performance of his austerities, there was anxiety in his mind. And so, and then there was also the previous Dilipa's father who'd performed austerities. So Was it the accumulation of the austerities over three generations that finally brought about the reciprocation from Ganges, or was it particularly King Bhagirath's, mood with which he performed the austerities that led to Ganges to be pleased to reciprocate finally after the three generations?
I don't know, it doesn't say. My mind went to Bhakti Vinod Thakur, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati and Prabhupada. It's not that one's mood was any different from the others. One's just carrying out their particular service with that determination to carry out and fulfill what the previous one started off. So I'm not sure if there's an accumulation, or perhaps there's a continuity. It doesn't say this way or that way. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.